Welcome to Great Loop Radio, brought to you by America's Great Loop Cruisers Association. We're dedicated to sharing Great Loop information and inspiration with those actively cruising, planning for, or dreaming about a Great Loop adventure. I'm Kim Russo. I'm the director of AGLCA, and today we are going to talk a little bit about captain's licenses and what's required for them, why you might want one for the loop. To do that, my guest today is Nate Gilman, and he is with MMCs, which is a brand new sponsor of AGLCA, so we thank them for that. And we will jump into that topic in just a moment, but speaking of sponsors, we do want to take a moment to recognize and thank our Admiral level sponsors who support AGLCA at the highest level. They are Curtis Stokes & Associates, Passage Maker Trawler Fest, Skipper Bob Publications, and Waterway Guide Media. As always, we encourage our listeners to support these businesses that support the Great Loop. And as I mentioned, MMCs is another brand new AGLCA sponsor and our supporting loopers. So Nate Gilman, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kim. Thank you for being here. It's really exciting.
Yeah, well, and it's great to have you here to kind of fill us in on captain's licenses, because that is where you specialize. But let's start. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your boating experience.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up in Puget Sound. I come from a very old maritime family in the area. So my baby picture is me in a 5-gallon bucket before I could stand on the back deck of our trawler, because I would slide back and forth before I could walk. And so that's kind of where I lived. And I ended up kind of carrying along that tradition all the way through. So I grew up racing sailboats and then playing on boats in the San Juans, worked on passenger vessels, ended up going to college, and I did this sea education, which is sailing a tall ship to weird and exotic places. So I sailed from Key West to Nova Scotia, stopping in Bermuda, just using a sextant and a taffrail log the whole way, which was really fun to kind of learn those pieces. And that all grew to, I became a NOAA Commissioned Corps Officer, and I served in the NOAA Corps for 7 years. I ran boats up in the Arctic. I ran some boats up around the Gulf of Mexico and then up and down the Eastern Seaboard, doing different missions from mapping the seafloor to looking at fisheries and pollock and chasing seals up in the Arctic sea ice. So it was a pretty fun time. But since I was a baby, this is pretty much all I've done is play on boats.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of people's dream jobs that you've had over the course of time. But now you are with MMCs and helping people. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about that, but mostly helping people get and maintain their captain's credentials, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So MMCs is the little book we hold is called a Merchant Mariner Credential, or an MMC is what us captains call the slang term for that. So MMCs is our cute, fun name for a software that we wrote that makes it really, really simple and easy to deal with all the paperwork. So getting your captain's license, you go to a school, you take the exams, it's pretty intense and fun. And then you end up stuck with this pile of paperwork you have to figure out. And it doesn't matter if you're the captain of a large container ship all the way down to, you know, someone that's working on their first 6-pack license, the pile of paperwork is frustrating. I think today I saw the smallest pile was 13 pieces of paper that you had to have dialed in for someone renewing a very basic, easy one. The biggest one I've seen this week is 65 different pieces of paper that are put together that have to be in the right order, stacked, not missing any signatures or any other pieces. And so what we did is we wrote a piece of software that makes that as simple and easy as possible. So you can track all of your sea time, make sure you have the right training certificates, make sure you have all those other little pieces that get in the way, just to make it super simple. It's everything that we wish we had when we were growing up and getting our licenses, our whole team as professional mariners. So we kind of build everything we want and then try to make it better for everyone else.
Yeah. Well, and as, you know, obviously part of helping others do this, you've got some tips that we're going to go through that, you know, where mistakes are often made, so that people can listen to this and kind of get some ideas on where they need to be extra careful when they're going through that process. But let's start, you know, kind of from the beginning. Who is required to have a captain's license?
Yeah, so only someone that is working on an inspected vessel in the United States is required to have a captain's license. If you are taking paying passengers on an uninspected vessel, which is the majority of boats, if you don't have a certificate of inspection and you're not inspected by the Coast Guard on an annual basis, you have an uninspected passenger vessel typically, which means every boat can be an uninspected passenger vessel. And from there, you need to have a 6-pack license, which is an OUPV, if you're going to be taking paying passengers out on your uninspected passenger vessel. If you are happen to work as a captain, say at like a dinner ship tour boat all the way up to the guys that are driving big container ships, that each one of those boats have a certificate of inspection. And that certificate of inspection clearly lays out what type of captain's license needs to be operating that boat, from a 25 ton master, 25 ton mate, all the way up to an unlimited master of, you know, the biggest boats possible. But for the most part, it depends. Most people don't end up getting their captain's license because it's required. Most people end up getting their captain's license because it helps them become a better mariner. So they're learning what the rest of those tugboats and those big container ships and all the people that are driving around you, you understand the language they're speaking, what they're saying with their lights, what they're saying with all the different pieces in a very formalized manner that then you can honestly brag about to everyone else that you're a professional and you've raised yourself to that standard, which is what the majority of people in the United States who have captain's licenses, they don't use it for work. They use it to be able to like make sure they're up to snuff.
Yeah. So we get questions a lot from members who are getting ready to do their own Great Loop. And they often say, you know, should I get a captain's license? And unless they're taking passengers for hire for a looping boat, they don't need one. You know, you just kind of mentioned that it kind of ensures that you have a lot of knowledge about how the professional mariners go about their business. Any other thoughts on, you know, why a looper might want to consider a captain's license before they start their loop?
Yeah. And I would actually suggest, like, you can do it at any time because you're not taking paying passengers, and the whole point is to learn as much as you can about how the system works, right? Because you're entering, when you go on the loop and you're going up and down the intercoastal waterway, or you're cutting in through New York Harbor and you're going through all those boats, all of them are trying to communicate the entire time. Even if they're not talking on VHS 16 or 13, they're still telling you everything you need to know about them. Daytime, nighttime, by the way they're driving their boat, by the way that you're seeing the angles that come in. And if you don't understand that language, it's almost scary and dangerous. And it's a place that you learn through the captain's license classes and other pieces that you start learning, oh, okay, they're saying two whistles means we're going to see each other port to port. That's great, right? Like, but if you don't know that and you're going through that ICW, that's a kind of interesting and scary thing. And if you're going on the loop, it means you're a professional. You're starting to get to that point where you're not just the person that's taking your boat out for 35 minutes to go get cocktails just offshore. You're actually like really committed to kind of having this big adventure and seeing the whole different parts of how the professional maritime work works. And having that extra knowledge seems to make a ton of sense of just, even if you don't use MMCs, even if you don't even get your license, taking that class to understand how all these things are working together and what everyone else is kind of expecting. My favorite part of taking captain's license classes has nothing to do with the class part. Like, I love the class part. I love learning. I love seeing those other parts. It's interacting with the other professionals and learning about what they're doing in their different pieces. Cause there will be guys from tugboats that are starting to get their piece. There'll be folks from getting their, you know, women from research vessels that are getting their 100 ton or different pieces as well for different requirements. So you get to learn a lot about the maritime industry in places that you normally would never get a hit. So that's the other exciting part for me all the time, is I advise people to do that.
Yeah. One of the things that loopers question, and this is a tough one in this day and age, it's an insurance question. And we all, if you've listened to this podcast at all, everyone who's listening knows that insurance is nothing, that there's kind of a set in stone answer to any insurance question these days. But some of our members wonder and expect that if they get a captain's license, they may be seen more favorably by insurance companies. We hear kind of anecdotal evidence that in the past, I think that was very much true. Now we kind of hear not so much. Everybody's case is different, but are you hearing anything out there, Nate, about, you know, from people who are going through your process to actually get the credential, are anything insurance related that might be able to share?
Yeah, what we're hearing, and we talk to insurance companies pretty often, just, mm-hmm. you know, casually, is we're supporting some of the things behind the scenes, because every insurance company wants their people they're insuring to be as professional as possible to reduce their risk and liability as many ways as they can. And so we end up having some interesting conversations. And the main overarching thing that we're hearing is, like, talk to your broker. And your broker will be able to really define each piece and kind of put things together, that each case is kind of different. And there isn't one generic company that we're hearing right now that is just blatantly giving everyone that has a, you know, 25 ton near coastal master a cut on their insurance. But instead, there's different brokers or people that bundle things together that, you know, that it's a roundabout answer of saying, go have a conversation with the person who you're willing to give money to, and they will probably give you a really, really good answer for your exact situation.
Yeah. And everybody's situation is different. And, you know, some of the insurance questions depend on the boat. It depends on your previous boat ownership. There's just so many factors that it's really hard to answer that. I mean, I would love to tell people it really can't hurt to have that credential. But, you know, the insurance companies are the ones that's going to make that final decision. Mm-hmm. Another place that we get questions, there seems to be this kind of boating folklore that if you have that captain's credential and you are involved in some kind of an incident, you are held to a higher standard than your average recreational boater. We've seen that pop up in our Facebook group, and it's always a very heated discussion by some people insisting that you are in fact held to a higher standard, and then others saying, no, you're absolutely not. Any take on that? What have you learned about that over the years?
Yeah, for sure. With the kind of liability and the way that maritime law is built, we always have a share of the basically problem. Like, it's very hard for the most part, except for an elision, which is when you run into a stationary vessel, and that stationary vessel even needs to be like stationary at the dock and no one is around. It's always a share of the guilt, basically, of there's two people on two different boats coming together and they both ended up making mistakes as things happen. With that in mind, I have searched over and over kind of four different places that support or defend that. And there's a couple articles from around 2000 that really go into deep detail on that it's not true. And then from then, we've always been looking for case law just to kind of support it either way, because at MMCs, we're always just looking for the facts. Like, we don't really care what the answer is. We just need a answer. And this is one of the ones that we've never seen case law come through that has said, because a recreational boater and another recreational boater got into a collision, one recreational boater held the captain's license, the other one did not hold the captain's license, that the recreational boater who held the captain's license was held to a higher standard. I've never seen that case law come through yet. If anyone has it, I'd love to see it. Like, please, like, that sounds great. But at the moment, I've never come across that so far.
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, that's, I've seen that challenge, you know, show me some case law that supports that. And I've never actually seen that either. So I guess to wrap up that part, it's pretty safe to say that fear of additional liability is not a good reason to not go ahead and get a captain's credential if you're interested in getting it. That's really not a reason that should stop you.
Until we can find some case law or something that happens, like, yeah, I don't think that's an actual thing that stops you from getting that.
Yeah. Okay. So with a little bit of that stage setting done, I do want to kind of hop into what some of the requirements are. And as we said, you have some places that people tend to kind of mess this up if they're working on submitting all of that paperwork. So let's take a quick break and play a message from a sponsor, and we'll jump into all that when we come back.
Sounds great.
All right. We'll be back in a moment. Pebble Isle Marina is the perfect stop for AGLCA members to enjoy docktails, conveniently located in a sheltered harbor on the Tennessee River at mile marker 96. The marina's 600 plus feet of transient dockage offers slips convenient to all amenities and can accommodate boats of all styles and sizes up to 100 feet in length. Our fuel dock offers ethanol-free gas and high-speed diesel pumps with a ship store for supplies. Our floating seasonal restaurant offers beautiful views of Kentucky Lake from the patio. Check out the Pebble Isle website for details of special offers for AGLCA members. We're back on Great Loop Radio. My guest today is Nate Gilman. He is with MMCs. They are a brand new sponsor of AGLCA. And we are talking about captain's licensing. We've covered the fact that you do not need one for the loop, but we've also given some reasons that you might want to consider it. So Nate, let's go ahead and jump in. You know, what are the steps to qualify for a U.S. Coast Guard Mariner license?
Yeah, totally. So the whole process always starts with sea service. Depending on the license that you're getting, they all have different requirements. So the lowest requirement is 360 days on any bit of water that you've been assisting with the safe navigation of the vessel. And then that goes all the way up to 720 days is the near coastal 100 ton, which is the one that most people end up getting. as they grow their Coast Guard licenses to the top, as you kind of push that through. Mm-hmm. From there, you need to make sure to have training. So training is as easy as going to a Coast Guard licensing school. They're offered online, they're offered in person, they're offered blended, they're all over the place. And it's the OUPB six pack is one common course that people take. And that one course will cover your Great Lakes endorsement. If you have time on the Great Lakes, which most loopers will have when they finish, you need 90 days on the Great Lakes, your OUPB near coastal, which means you have 90 days being outside the sea buoys or offshore, as we call it, for near coastal. And then inland is just 360 days. The most classes cover that piece. And then there's an upgrade, which is the 100 ton course, which then is the same kind of requirements, just expanded. So it becomes a little bit higher on your offshore requirements you need to have for each piece. The one that no one talks about is you need to have CPR and first aid within 1 year. So the progression we normally suggest is get all that sea time, keep documenting it, kind of keeping your log, keeping however you want. I personally, before we built MMCs, had 9 different Google spreadsheets that all had different things as I was growing and looking for different licenses, which was very confusing, but I was always planning which ships, which boats I was working on to grow that license up. Once you have that, you have to take CPR first aid. Once you've gotten those kind of nailed down at the same time, you have to pass a Coast Guard physical. The Coast Guard physical is really, really, really basic and simple, but the paperwork is pretty confusing. We'll talk about that in detail in a sec. A TWIC is your transportation worker identification card. Every first license, you need to have one TWIC. When you get your TWIC, the thing to remember is that that is your picture on your Coast Guard license. It's the main reason we do it as a background check, but also it becomes your image. So if you want to look good on your Coast Guard license, make sure your TWIC picture is good looking. You need to do a drug test. Drug test is a very specific 5-panel DOT drug test that the Coast Guard will not accept any other drug test but that one. That's to verify your identity. They just want to make sure you are who you say you are. There is an oath. The oath is a kind of silly thing, but you do that in front of a notary. And then there are the federal fees that they charge you, which vary depending on what license you're getting. You fill out the official form, and then you submit that to a regional exam center. Our software helps you with all of these things in different ways, guides you through the whole pieces. But even if you don't use us, it's confusing, but they're kind of set out in a row of these kind of 10 steps to make it pretty simple and easy.
Yeah. And there's actually a lot there. I mean, you know, you hear people worrying about the sea service and passing the test. But the other steps are not something you hear too much about. So it's really interesting to kind of hear you walk through what they are. But you say that there are 5 that specifically kind of trip people up where you see mistakes made that, you know, result in perhaps not getting that license in the timely manner that you might be hoping to. So kind of walk us through that. Where are some of the pitfalls that people seem to get stumble in?
Yeah, no, totally. So it's really just sea service, the medical, the drug test, verifying your identity, and getting your oath done. They're all actually some of the simplest ones, but they require a little bit of kind of finesse to nail through each one.
Let's talk about the sea service a little bit more first. You did give us some of the number of days, but go ahead and do that one more time because it is one of the important pieces. I want to make sure people catch that.
Yeah, for sure. So we'll just start with sea service. Sea service, mm-hmm. People have so many questions like, what is a sea day? What counts as a sea day? Can I get time and a half if I've worked all day for 24 hours? And we'll start at the very beginning. A sea day is any time you've been away from the pier for over 4 hours in a 24-hour period. So you could go leave the pier 4 times for an hour and go do whatever and come back, and that counts as one sea day. You can be offshore on your boat or cruising for a full 24-hour period, that counts as one sea day. So it's over 4 hours, up to 24 hours is a sea day. The thing that makes you different than a passenger is that you're assisting with the safe navigation of the vessel. So that means you are partaking in whatever's going on. You are looking out the window, making sure you don't hit a deadhead. You are, you know, making sure that the boat is tied up nice when you get back, like all those different pieces that you're assisting with the safe navigation of the vessel, that helps create it as a sea day. And a rumor that goes around that has been changed in the last 10 years, it used to be real, was that there was a certain size boat you had to be on. They've removed that. So it's any boat from a stand-up paddleboard, if you wanted to go stand-up paddleboard for 4 hours, which I wouldn't recommend, all the way to any size vessel. If you're assisting with the safe navigation and it's over 4 hours on any waters in the United States, that is a sea day. How you document that, the MMC software can help you a lot, but there's basically four main areas of sea service that you have. Your inland time, so that's any time that you are basically from the sea buoy or the edge of that breakwater, that safe water buoy or the breakwater inside, that's all considered inland time. So that's the most generic normal time. So that's cruising around Chesapeake Bay, that's going in the ICW, that's going down the Mississippi River. The second you get outside of that sea buoy, so you go say offshore in Virginia and you drive out of Norfolk and you want to go up to Long Island Sound, as you're going through there, that's all considered near coastal time, or we call it seaward of the boundary line. And that all accumulates as its own piece. Once you hit the Great Lakes, you guessed it, that counts as Great Lakes time. And then oceans is over 200 nautical miles from shore. A dirty little secret is that oceans time and near coastal time are counted the exact same for the Coast Guard. You get no extra points for being 200 nautical miles offshore. The second you've left that safe water buoy and gone offshore, you're good to go. And that counts towards your near coastal time and then oceans time if you wanted to do it. For the OUPB, as we talked about, you need to have 360 total days. And so your baseline is always 360 days that you're going for. So 360 days that you've been underway for over 4 hours, assisting with the safe navigation, and that will get you your inland OUPV. If 90 of those 360 days you spent offshore, so you're outside of the sea buoy, that then counts towards your near coastal. If 90 of those days were spent on the Great Lakes, operating around the Great Lakes, then that can add to a Great Lakes endorsement together. So it's, they have kind of a hierarchy as they go. As you work on those, if you ever did want to, your near coastal works on inland, your Great Lakes works on inland, but your inland doesn't work on near coastal, and your inland typically doesn't work on Great Lakes, just to kind of understand the hierarchy a little bit. The next one that gets a little bit more confusing and frustrating is everyone takes the 100-ton course, but very few people work on boats big enough or have sea time from boats big enough to get your 100-ton in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So the tonnage time, typically most people will take the course. They do that 360 days again for your inland license. And that means 360 days on near coastal waters, Great Lakes, inland, ocean, whatever, will get you that inland 100-ton license. But it will end up with a tonnage limitation because the Coast Guard thinks about things in 25, 50, and 100-ton. And so you'll end up with, most people will take the class for 100-ton. They'll end up with a 25 gross ton inland is that first 360 days. And then there's some little tricks we can play down the line of 90 days at a time can, on any boats on any water, we'll get you your 50 ton. And then when you hold your 50 ton, 90 days on any will get you up higher. But I can rant about these for a long time.
I have a question, just to make sure, kind of from a looper perspective, we're clear on it. You mentioned a sea day is any day that 4 hours and 24-hour period you're away from the dock. But you have to actually, the boat has to be underway. So for example, if you're at anchor, and you spend a full day at anchor somewhere, if you haven't lifted the anchor and actually gone somewhere for 4 hours, that would not count as a sea day, correct?
It depends on if you're on the boat. So it takes, like, the anchoring is a gray area depending on what you're doing. So if you were tied to the pier, definitely. But if you're at anchor, hopefully you have an anchor watch kind of set. You have your nav equipment all set up. Like, you know, you're doing stuff that's related to making sure that boat does not drag anchor and end up in someone's backyard by accident, mm-hmm. or anywhere else, right? So yep. If you're doing the work towards that, it can, depending on your kind of like best judgment,
right,
be counted as a sea day. If you're against a pier, absolutely not. But if you're kind of paying attention to the safe navigation of that boat the whole time, and it, because some people live at anchor and they're like gone all the time, and that definitely doesn't count, like if you're doing mooring ball, but Sure. It's kind of that gray area that if you're assisting with the safe navigation of the boat and doing stuff that is pretty close to underway.
Well, that does make sense, though. Yeah, I can certainly see the discernment there between being against a pier and being at anchor when you're making sure you're not dragging and all of those things that are associated with that. So
if
what
you're
is it?
Getting good sleep, the rule we'd say is like, if you're getting good sleep, you are definitely not underway. But if you're like paying attention to things and having to like, you know, still be, then it's, yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, well, what is it about the sea time that tends to trip people up? Is it just knowing what the requirement is, or is it something about the way people might be tracking or perhaps the lack of tracking and recording that?
Yeah, you nailed it. So it's definitely the lack of tracking and kind of coming back later and being like, okay, where was those 360 days? The most common form that gets used is called a CG-719S. And that's a small vessel sea service form that works for any boat under 200 gross tons. So that's every looper boat pretty much is going to be under 200 gross tons. And so you can use this form, you can fill it all out. The main places where people kind of get tripped up is that they do the math wrong. There's 60 places to put all the math in for the last 5 years for months. And you'll put in all that information and then you won't add it all correctly together. So your total days doesn't match the total days they have on top. And then there's a section where you divide your total days divided by the number of Great Lakes days, the number of inland days, the number of near coastal days. And just the way the world works, a lot of people don't get those three numbers to add up to your total days. Mm-hmm. Coast Guard will reject that again. And it just becomes this process. Inside of MMCs, we check for all of that. So we let you know if there's a problem and it doesn't make sense and you can update it. Or we also have it so that the software, you can do it all manually inside of the software and it will do all the math for you. So you don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. And it will also kind of look for all those errors. The other place people mess up, which sounds silly, is everyone forgets to sign their own forms. So if you're working with someone else, there's two spots to sign on that form. Most people get the captain or the owner they were working with before to sign that bottom part. And they always forget to sign for themselves. Or if they own their own vessel, they typically sign the top part for themselves and forget to sign the bottom part again for themselves with the owner information that happens. So.
Gotcha. Okay. Another place you say that a lot of people make mistakes is the medical exam, which seems a little bit odd. So tell us where we are typically messing that up.
Yeah, no problem. So the medical exam is, it's the most frustrating, simple thing you'll do in this whole process. Any doctor, nurse practitioner, or physician's assistant in the United States can sign and give you your whole exam, but you'll run into across the country, it's a really scary looking form that you have to do it on. It's a CG-719K, it's 10 pages. It looks super intimidating. There's boxes all over the place for all these different things. But the reality is it's like simpler than a high school physical as you go through. And what really bothers me more than anything is the audiology exam. There is this box where you have to have to make sure you can hear whistles. It makes sense. So there's a whole section. It has all these different exam kind of boxes and really weird looking audiology exams from the 60s and 70s that people really don't do anymore. And then in fine little bold print right along the bottom, it says the doctor shall whisper from 5 feet away. If the mariner can hear it, they pass. And all doctors miss that little tiny section, which just says whisper from 5 feet away. And they're good. And instead they see all the scary boxes and words and start going to town, like ordering you audiology things. I have stories from people that have like been at the doctor and they're dusting things off they haven't used in 10 years and like pulling random like, you know, booths out and just all this crazy stuff. And I like get on the phone with the doc and I'm like, hey, whisper from 5 feet away. The most common thing, maritime doctors who are used to this, like guys in the Keys and you know, up in Norfolk, they just say roses are red randomly at you throughout the entire thing. And if you say, you know, violets are blue, they pass. You never even know you did the audiology exam. But that's the thing that really trips people up. And it's,
That's a good insider tip for sure. Another one, you mentioned the drug test, it has to be a very specific drug test. Is that, you know, kind of a breaking point on people messing that up? Is it not getting the right one? And how do you know?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a DOT 5-panel drug test. It's very specific. It's a simple drug test. And it has to be done at a lab that sends it off to a medical review officer. A lot of places in the US will give you a drug test, and they love to give you a drug test, and they will charge you for your drug test, and it will not be the right drug test. So it's one of the most common things we see from just like the kind of quick, easy errors that people that weren't using MMCs go do inside of MMCs. Like, we, it's a place we put a lot of work into. So we give you a PDF that opens up on your phone that you can like hold in front of the receptionist you're working with, or when you're talking on the phone to schedule it. And you're like, I need this exact exam. Do you do this? A lot of places do it. They just don't even realize they do it. And so it gets, having the exact right verbiage is one of the things that makes it way, way easier, because it's, again, super simple. It's actually a cheaper one of the Coast Guard or the drug tests, but you got to have the right one. Otherwise it's frustrating to have to pay $120 again.
Sure.
Over and over, you take the wrong one.
Absolutely. Identity verification. That's another place that you say a lot of people mess that up. So what typically goes wrong there?
Yeah. So that one's just, no one tells you. It's not the other checklists. It's not really very publicly known. So if you're just ripping through on your own, it's really the Coast Guard ends up kicking it back at you and saying you need to verify your identity. And then you end up in this catch 22 where you're trying to figure out what it is. Verifying your identity is as simple as including your birth certificate or a passport when you submit your first application. You only have to do it once. It only goes in your first one, but it's just how they verify everything else behind the scenes. So it's actually super, super simple. People don't really mess it up once they get told, because getting your birth certificate or your passport is really easy, but it's one of those things that isn't on any lists or anywhere. That's just, you're just supposed to know to do it, which is frustrating for us. So, you know, we guide you through and keep it in there. But
okay, yeah. Excellent. And then one of the final things you mentioned in kind of the list of things that you must do is the mariner's oath. So where's the pitfall for us there?
Yeah, so the oath, there's a couple things. It feels really weird because you have to say an oath in front of someone, and people get kind of weirded out of going to a bank and saying, hey, but that oath can be performed by any notary in the United States that you're interacting with, right? So you can go to any bank, any realtor, anyone you want, and they will issue your oath. It has to be stamped by the notary. A lot of notaries randomly won't issue your stamp, is a random thing. So they'll write their number down, but it has to have that official stamp on it. And the form that is the one from the Coast Guard has a giant sample written across it. And that's totally fine. That is the one that you download. Everything's good. But notaries get very hung up on it. It says sample across it. You're like, yes, it does. But no one at the Coast Guard has ever removed the sample, which is the one, the official one you download. And so that's where it is. But it's, you know, any notary in the US can do it for you anywhere you find. And just the sample is okay. And it's pretty easy. But
yeah. So anything that I've missed that you would want people to know about getting a Coast Guard license or how the process works?
No, I think it's, we covered a lot as we went through. I really appreciate it. And it's, yeah, if you have questions, you know, we're always happy to kind of answer those questions and think about new ways. We're all a bunch of nerdy boat captains that love learning and figuring out how to just basically tell the truth, as opposed to all the sea lawyering that you hear in the bar all the time, which is fun to talk about, but we've kind of accumulated everything with real facts, which has been exciting for us, but we love getting stumped. So if you have any questions, or other places, we're always happy to kind of answer those. And yeah, check out mmcs.com. It's free to use for all you want. If you want one-on-one expert help, then we charge $99 a year. And if you want unlimited crazy weird help, which I don't think anyone on the loop would, we charge like $8.99 to just basically take care of everything behind the scenes for someone.
Yeah.
But it's free to play with and use and track and figure it out on your own. And we're just always here to help.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We appreciate that. Again, we appreciate your sponsorship. MMCs will be joining us at the upcoming Spring Rendezvous. So if you are registered for that, you can meet Nate there. There is still space available for the Spring Rendezvous. It's more than half sold out, but if you're contemplating and trying to decide, the greatloop.org website has a link on the homepage directly to the event. It's or you can go to greatloop.org/spring to find it. So we'll look forward to seeing lots of you there. Nate, again, thanks for sharing all these tips. I actually learned a lot. I don't have a captain's license. And based on our time around the loop, We spent too many days attached to a dock. had we done more anchoring, perhaps I would have the sea time, but I don't yet. But that's okay. I'll keep working towards that. And a great way to track it and know when I have that time. So thank you for sharing the details.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. And a thank you to everyone who has listened or watched today. We'll be back next week with another episode of Great Loop Radio Podcast. Until then, safe cruising.